NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Cruz.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Good day, Todd. How are you today?
Oh, not bad at all. And we decided to go into the archives of the NTSB and look for something that is an ongoing interest item of ours, training accidents.
And it fits right into the way you are today with your flying. As I read it, I was thinking about some of the conversations that we've had over the last multiple months about and where you are coming back.
And I'm still climbing slowly but surely toward getting my instrument rating on a G1000 Cessna 172. And I say that because I'm also looking beyond my instrument rating to a commercial rating. And you can get that on a single engine aircraft, technically advanced aircraft. A G1000 Cessna 172 fits that criteria. So I'm hoping that what I'm learning now will be able to be applied to my commercial training. And I say that because this particular accident, which happened on November 11th, 2021, is a fatal accident that happened in New Jersey, near Branchville, New Jersey. There was an instructor pilot who had almost 15,000 hours, virtually all of it in a Cessna 172, according to the accident report. And the student pilot already had about 400 hours, including several hundred hours in the Cessna 172. And looking at the logbook of the student, which is part of the public docket, the student was doing some maneuvers, had noted some maneuvers in previous flights with its instructor that were consistent with the requirements for a commercial pilot. So the accident itself, the aircraft was took off from the outskirts of the New York metropolitan area, headed northwest toward the fairly rural part of New Jersey near the Pennsylvania border, near the Delaware River, and they're doing a variety of maneuvers. And they had climbed up to about 6,000 feet. And shortly after that, the aircraft entered a very steep spiral and went straight into the ground, killed both of the people on board, unfortunately. There was nothing found with the aircraft that showed that the aircraft was had any sort of mechanical fault or what have you. And surprisingly, even though this aircraft was descending at one point about 6,000 feet per minute, all the various parts of the aircraft were intact. The ailerons, elevator, et cetera, were still at the crash scene. So it looks like they did not fall off the aircraft. So in my opinion, prior to this aircraft entering into this very steep spiral, the aircraft was capable of fly. Now, John and I were talking about this before we recorded, and we had some insights as to what was going on here. I mean, John, the instructor pilot had, and let me read the numbers right, because it was fairly impressive, a grand total of 14,750 hours of flight, and virtually all of it with this same make and model. And the student was 440 hours total, 369 hours total in this make and model, which is a Cessna 172. Both of these people, presumably, had a lot of experience in the 172.
You know, sometimes that can lead to complacency. You know, so if the flight instructor may have been comfortable with this guy entering into spins and his ability to get out of them, but something got away from him today. And if the flight instructor wasn't on the controls with him to feel what was going on, he might not have got to them quick enough before they got themselves in too deep to recover quickly. But they had enough altitude. I can remember when I flew, we would come up to 5 or 6,000 feet, and he'd make me do a stall and a spin. And I'll tell you what, I remember him being right on it, yelling in my ear the minute I made a mistake, not waiting, not letting me let it go unnoticed. He was right on my case. And I got to be pretty good with them, because every time we went out, the last thing we did on the way back was a recovery, stall recovery. And I went away from it for years. And I was rather taken back when I found out that they today's requirements, you don't have to do a stall. And that, maybe that's why we have so many of that type of accidents in general aviation.
When you mentioned the 6,000 feet, I thought to myself, why did I go to 6,000 feet? Fortunately for me, the NTSB included in the public docket a portion of the pilot's operating handbook that stated if you're going to do a stall and spin training sort of thing, do so at about 6,000 feet. Give yourself plenty of room, that a single turn in a spin might lose 1,000 feet. If you do multiple turns in the spin, let's say up to six, which I thought was a fairly high number, allow for 2,000 feet. Where this event occurred, they're about 6,000 feet above ground level. So they had adhered to that part of the operating handbook, certainly. And I thought to myself, given that this person, the student, had about 400 hours total, this person was certainly not trying to get his private license. And this was not a maneuver that's required for instrument training. And I thought, is this something that's consistent with maybe a commercial certification? And I checked the ACS, the Airman Certification Standards for Commercial Pilot, and I looked, what is the requirement to perform a spin? And I looked through it, and there was certainly a requirement to identify the conditions that go into it. Certainly a requirement for understanding the risk, but there's no requirement to actually demonstrate that. So if this person was indeed working on a commercial certification, there was no need to actually go through the kind of spin that they started out with that turned into a spiral they couldn't get out of.
Yeah, it sort of defies description here. I mean, they really set themselves up pretty nicely for the practice. I mean, at the right altitude, he slowed the airplane down. They had plenty of power available if he needed it. It just doesn't make sense other than they were slow to respond and got in over their head. Did the flight instructor let him go more than into the second turn? Did he let it go one more? I mean, he can still get out three or four. It gets more difficult because sometimes the airplane gets to be pretty violent in the maneuver, and it's the way it's coming down, the spin. I don't know. There's some problems with the drug testing, but not major problems, but there is some indications of prior use. You know, a lot of people don't realize today that how sensitive the drug testing is, and they can tell if you've done something you shouldn't be doing a long time out.
We're mentioning that because in the report and in the public docket, there's toxicology reports on the instructor where there was evidence that there was THC in a system, but no evidence of recent use. And I thought to myself, well, when it comes to your certification, not just for being a pilot, but mechanic or any other FAA certification, marijuana, which has the active ingredient THC, is not allowed, period, under any circumstances. So if this person had this in the system and the FAA were aware of it, the FAA would have taken away the certification of the instructor. Now, that said, it brings up some ancillary issues, and you were talking about this earlier. We both work with young people coming up in aviation. And you said that in a presentation to a group at one of the aviation institutions we've been associated with, their ears really perked up when you mentioned gummies. How exactly did that work?
Well, I forget how it came up, but we talked to them and said, you know, smoking or gummies will get you disqualified. And they perk right up, a few of them. What do you mean? Is it gummies for putting the THC into your system? And even if you get the ones that say that they don't have it, they're low, below the threshold. Not today. And plus, there's no FDA requirements to adequately screen all the gummies on its content. And you know what? We even have songs that talk about my gummies just kicked in. I mean, it's really crazy. But gummies are just as bad as smoking. And I think that my conversation with the students indicated to me, non-technical, that these kids were using it, because why else would they get so alert so quickly about the subject? And we got into a rather longer discussion about what they need to pay attention to. And the fact that you can, today's testing can go back so far. I was told not long ago, like a year or two ago, that they can clearly see that you've smoked marijuana more than 60 days back. That's a long way back. And I know people that'll go away on vacation and think they're free and clear, and they'll go party with their significant others. And then they come back to work and get drug tested. Bingo. It's going to show up in your system. And I know of a couple of people that happened to. So it's best to stay away from it, period.
And getting back to this accident in THC, again, they noted that there was THC in the instructor's system. There is no indication in the report, nor no claim in the report, that that led to the accident. So that aside, you know, basically, if you want to have a career in aviation, stay away from any form of marijuana, THC, gummies, etc. Now, getting back to the accident again, it begs the question, what were they thinking? Well, John and I, who both had flight instruction in different eras, we were reading up where it has been since 1949 when private pilots were last required to demonstrate or experience spins during the training. Both of us had that happen well after 1949. So the fact that instructors go above and beyond the regulations with respect to exposing their students to spins, that's fairly common. And in fact, I think it's a useful, worthwhile experience to go through that, because no matter what you do, whether reading in a book or going in a simulator, even if it's a full motion simulator, there's nothing like the real thing and the kind of experience and feelings you have doing that. And the desire I had after having those experiences, not to put myself in a position to do that. Now, that said, was the instructor giving this person spin training? We don't know. There was no cockpit voice recorder. Fortunately for this accident investigation, it had a Garmin G1000 in it, which recorded a lot more information than we would have gotten just from a straight ADS-B recording. In fact, I looked up the ADS-B track of this accident flight, and it stopped well before the G1000's data stopped. So it's good that we have this, and that it clearly shows that what was the airplane doing before it went to a spin.
Yeah, I wish all the general aviation airplanes had some kind of a recorder that would capture the same material, but that's just dreaming. It's just, I have to shake my head with the instructor. He had to be distracted or just not on his game to let the student get ahead of him. And who knows, maybe the student got ahead of him and then they both were fighting for control of the airplane. I mean, there's no way that we're ever going to tell that. But it could be that, you know, the student panicked or anything could have happened. Medical emergency. And, you know, this pilot was a big guy, tall guy and heavy. So if he was a fall under the controls because he, let's say, a heart attack, which is no indication of in the medical, but if he had fallen on the controls, the instructor would have a hell of a time getting the airplane under control while it's spinning down and trying to get this guy off the yoke. So we'll never know what it is, but it clearly would indicate a possibly slow response on the part of the instructor.
Now, some of the people in the audience might be saying to themselves, how can someone who is an instructor has had 14,000 plus hours in a Cessna 172, according to the report. How can they get themselves into this position? Well, as those of you who follow our podcasts have seen, we've done a couple of shows with extraordinarily competent people. Scott Crossfield, famous test pilot from the 1950s, was killed in an accident flying into a storm. And we did one not too long ago where there was a former lead pilot of the Thunderbirds who crashed with someone in the front seat of a single-engine aircraft. And you would think, these people know how to fly. Yes, they do. And this just points out the fact that just because you know a lot about flying, just because you have experience, just because you have the credentials, doesn't mean that inattention or whatever happened in this accident doesn't mean that circumstances can be such where you can be in a position you can't get out of.
Yeah, we see that a lot, actually. Right? You get an over your head. Broadly, it's complacency. You know, sometimes it's being cocky, but that's also the same form of complacency because you're throwing away what you know to be a hero. I mean, we did a couple of shows with guys showing off for their family or girlfriends or whoever with the airplanes flying low. And we did the one not, I can remember recently, where the guy crashed right in the vision of his house. And we have the other airplane that crashed at the birthday party. Right? Wasn't that in Mexico or something?
That was in Mexico. It was a baby reveal party. And there was an excellent video of that pretty much shows you exactly what happened. And again, they were doing something that was not a particular baby reveal party. This was a maneuver that was not quite standard. The person was flying a crop duster type aircraft, did a fairly aggressive pull up right before reaching the location. And the wing failed, the airplane rolled over and crashed right there.
Yeah. Happy event turned into a tragedy.
And, that was one of those situations where that video is educational in the sense of you can look at that years from now and get insights of, you know, what were the sequence of events from the decision making beforehand to, you know, the use of this aircraft that led to this. And what can I do to not put myself in that position? And this is the accident we're talking about today is the same thing. I mean, I'm going through instrument rating training. I'm planning on doing commercial training after that. And I'm becoming much more familiar with the requirements for all this. Going beyond the requirements is not necessarily a bad thing. Just because the FAA says I don't have to be exposed to it doesn't mean it will be a good educational experience to go through that. But you have to ask yourself, if you're going to do that with your instructor, I mean, certainly if you tell the instructor, I'm not comfortable with that. I don't want to go beyond the ACS, even if it means I have a better chance of not passing the test. I'm more comfortable staying within the limits of this. That's cool. Yeah. If you're a student and your instructor wants you to do something that is beyond the requirements, look at the risk and look at the rewards and make a decision.
Yes. Yes. And we all love to fly. We all love the adrenaline of doing something new. But you got to keep your wits about you. You got to stay, follow the book, you know, stay within the window that you have for your experience level. And these guys had a lot of experience, so they probably were outside of the parameters. You know, it's like scud running. People still do it all the time. Scud running. Oh yeah, I can get it done. I can get in. I can beat that thunderstorm. Yeah, well, many people do, but every once in a while the storm wins. And the outcome is not nice. Well, it's crazy. I think this was a useless loss of life in this case. I think it was a totally avoidable accident. Nothing mechanical came up. The engine was fine. The airframe, like you said earlier, all the bits and pieces were there, so they didn't exceed the limits of the mechanical limits of the fuselage. So, I mean, I think that these guys were doing something, most likely unusual attitudes, and got in over their head. And maybe they weren't as, if the instructor pilot wasn't as quick as he could have been, maybe he did have enough of that crap in his system to slow down his thinking. We'll never know. But obviously something was there that allowed him or the other, the lesser experienced pilot to get in over their head. And that came down like a rock.
Yeah, like 6,000 feet per minute toward the end.
Yep, that's fighter pilot territory, not commercial aviation. That's really aggressive. So that obviously wasn't planned. Something happened. Well, I think we talked this one to death. You know, it's wide open, except the fact, you know, the findings are wide open. The cause or the events that led them to get where they were and perish are open for discussion. What's not open for discussion is the fact that they got themselves outside of a safe operating envelope. And that's where you want to be. You don't want to be out on the edges. You know, you don't want to be scud running. You know, if airplanes that go high and fast, jet airplanes, coffin and corner comes up on you real quick. You know, an altitude, heavyweight airplanes. I mean, sometimes it's just a few knots between installing a commercial airplane at 30,000 feet of a safe cruise. We don't see that in general aviation, but we see it in commercial aviation, and it gets damn close. So, you know, it may not be coffin corner in the terms that everybody uses, but we still have coffin corners down in the general aviation environment, different set of circumstances, but it's still, you get in over your head, outside of the envelope for the airplane, and the outcome is pretty certain. You know, only takes some severe luck for you to avoid it. And in this case, they didn't have the luck. So I'll let you, Todd, I'll let you have the last word on this one.
Well, my last word, it is right up my alley. And, you know, like we were talking about before the show, I had to review my airman certification standards to see exactly what was required. And my message, my second to last word message is to all of you out there who are training, no matter what level of training you're doing, if you're following a curriculum to get an FAA certification, there's going to be some certification guidelines. If there are things coming up in your training that you're wondering about whether you have to do them or not have to do them, get familiar with looking at this certification standard document. Yes, it's an FAA document. Yes, it's kind of difficult to deal with, but sometimes you can find some gems like, do I have to do this thing? And if you don't have to do it, your instructor said, hey, let's have some fun and do this. This is a little extra something, something. You don't have to say yes. You can easily say no and still be within the regulations.
Yeah, the key is not going to get out on the edges, right? So, and again, as usual, because as we prepared for this one, we found that several others that sit right in my end, my speech at the end, my pleadings to everybody at the end. If you're going to go flying pre-flight, basic pre-flight before you leave the hotel or your house, do it again from scratch at the airport. You know, look at them to see how well they compare. Look for obvious mistakes. Make sure you get the weather here, there, and everywhere in between. We still have see that come up over and over and over. When you get out to your airplane, good pre-flight, touch your airplane. Shake your airplane. Wiggle your flight controls. It's very important. Find loose flight controls. Happens often. Happens often. When you get in the airplane, do the same thing with all your instrument checks, your mag checks. Do a thorough job. When you get in the air, please put that head on a swivel. There's just too many near misses out there today. Too many students. We got a record number of students and wannabe pilots out there. Not all of them are the most competent people in the world. So you need to pay attention. We are our brother's keeper because it's us too. You know, it doesn't matter if the student runs into the mid-air collision with a more experienced pilot or vice versa. The outcome is still bad for both of them. So you got to make sure you pay attention to the environment that you're operating in. And if it's too busy, go somewhere else. You know, take an extra 20-minute flight out of the area. So if you're gonna practice yourself, you have some elbow room. then please, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.